Odin and says the following thing. The material that he's about to present and to write, he says, is nothing that the reader does not know and is familiar with, but rather all the information, he says, is something that the people at large all have the information at hand. He says, the toelis, the benefit of my work, will be that it will give an opportunity for those who are specifically aware of all the material, and because of the basic nature of the material, that it is so well known, therefore something that is so well known as at the same time something one doesn't think about. One takes it for granted. Mitoch rof shituso, because of the simplicity of the matter. It's so basic and fundamental. Kach helam mimeno, so too is one oblivious of it. And in great measure, I think that defines many areas of potential growth that are stifled as a result of this phenomena, and specifically in the areas of the relationship between husband and wife. Now, I asked my Rebbe many years ago, it says, by Torah, hafochba v'hafochba dekolubah. And Torah is everything. Torah has all the wisdom of the world, all the secular wisdom and knowledge, all, of course, Torah knowledge, everything is in Torah. So I asked him, why doesn't it have abnormal psychology there? I don't see much abnormal psychology. Shiva, I must have heard thousands of shmuzin. I never heard abnormal psychology. Rare. So he said, you know, the Torah doesn't deal with abnormal psychology. Because most of abnormal psychology is aggravated normal psychology that becomes abnormal. Torah is a prescription for normative living. It tells one, you know, how to live a life in a normal fashion. If one does not follow the dictates of Torah, and one permits a situation to become out of hand, so that becomes abnormal. He says, Torah is not interested in speaking about the situation, what do you do after the matter becomes out of hand? But rather, the Torah's function is to arrest it at the beginning, in its formative stage. Literally, the Torah's function is to provide us a prescription for life. And I would like, in that fashion, just to outline, just briefly, that which you know so fundamentally true, and that which indeed is the prescription for a healthy and a successful and fulfilling marriage, is just the following thought. It's only two words. It's awareness and appreciation. That's all it is. You don't have to go to marriage encounter. You don't have to go to Allah classes. You don't have to be a Rosh Kapahag. You don't have to be a Rosh Hashiva. You don't have to be a psychologist. You have to be a mensch. It's all awareness and appreciation. A chaver, a colleague of mine in Los Angeles, I had occasion to speak to last week. And I asked him, you know, tell me something about marriage that you heard from the Rosh Hashiva. I'm always in the market to hear what somebody else heard from Rebbe. He says, I asked the Rosh Hashiva, when you look for a girl, what do you look for? He says, stability. And what is the secret to a good marriage? He said, Hakaras HaTov. To be able to recognize the good that you receive. Zehu. That's one. Just simple. Two words. Koras HaTov. You know, we just finished the holiday of Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat is a very, very amazing yantif. Amazing yantif. You know, it brings into focus many of the elements that are so integral to a good marriage. You know, there's a pasuk ki eitz ka'adam eitz hasadeh. You know, man is like the tree of the field. Pasuk, Reb Zev knows the pasuk, right? Ki adam eitz hasadeh. You know, if you stop and think, what are the elements that make up this is such a special time and how it relates to us? I was thinking, you know, sometimes you go out after davening, and particularly a few months ago, I recall vividly, the sky was so beautifully blue. There was an occasion that it was so blue, it was like the blue sky of Eretz Yisrael. Magnificently blue. One can't help but notice, you know. And sometimes I go out and I hear the birds, you know, when I turn to one, a bala bus outside, thought, do you hear the birds? Hearing it, the birds. Doesn't hear the birds. Okay. You know, I want, you know, to Giant, you know, you go to these places, you know, in Brooklyn, they have just these fruit stores. I don't think we have anything like that here. But in Brooklyn, in Flatbush, in Borough Park, you have just fruit stores. Just, that's all you have. And if you just for 1 minute think, you have all the different fruits and vegetables that there are. The availability. Yeah, summer and winter. And you stop and think just the fruits. And think of all the different colors that they come in. And all the different shapes they come in. And all the different flavors that they come in. And all the different species, you know, different types of apples. And the smell that each fruit has, that's different. The Eibishter didn't have to do that. We could have lived without fruits. Hey, stop to think. You walk down the aisles, just see Morabu Masecha Hashem. How wondrous and great are your deeds, Hashem. What did he do? We could have lived even without it. And if he wanted to be kind, so he'll give us a few fruits, but they all the same bland color, comes black and white. No. And all the different types of colors that he made. All for what reason? To be able to appeal to the person and to be mahana him, to bring him pleasure and joy. And even where it's not fundamentally necessary, it could have sufficed without it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to grace us. Now, the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu graced us, even that which was not necessary, one is required on Tu B'Shvat to take note of the bounty of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided for the human being, the array of colors and smells and tastes and shapes and beauty that he put inherent in all of these fruits, and to draw a lesson from it. And what's the lesson? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, listen, just as I did not require to do this, to give this to mankind, but I did it as an expression of my desire to be mahanet, to benefit him and to give him pleasure and joy, so too, in no less measure, are we obligated as well, mahu hafata, as God is, so too do we have to do, for halachta b'drachav, we have to follow his example. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu's purpose in Tafkid is to be Mahanet, to bring us joy and pleasure, so too we are to emulate him. And in the same way that he benefits us and gives us pleasure, when it isn't even necessary, al achas kama v'kama, surely we ourselves in kind have to do as he does. And wherever opportunity provides itself to be able to give to another and to benefit them, and to give him of the bounty and the pleasure, even when we have nothing to gain from it. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu had nothing to gain whatsoever from giving humanity the fruit that he gave us and the beauty that he endowed us with. So too, we are obligated in the very same measure to extend ourselves to the people as well, and to be honored them and to give them the pleasure and the joy as HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us as well. I was thinking about this, about Tu B'Shvat, and I said, If that is the obligation that we have to do in our relationship with people, to give them this benefit and joy and pleasure, how much more so are we mechuyev, are we obligated to extend ourselves to our wives? There is nobody in the world that we owe more to than the wives that we have. There is nobody that benefits us more, that interacts with us more, than one he has relationship with his wife. And I was thinking, you know, sometimes this relationship, because we do receive so much from our wives and the spouses, it only goes not only for husbands to wives, but wives to husbands as well. I was thinking, you know, inherently, the thought of the Mesillas Yesharim comes to mind. You know, it's because we receive so much that we're difficulty to take a step back and to appreciate what we have. We come to expect it. You know, if a stranger would do something that your wife would do for you once, you'd be so grateful to that person. And every time you'd meet that person, you'd say, you know what this person did? What a wonderful thing. Your wife does it day in and day out, looking for opportunity, looking for ways to bring pleasure, try to, you know, bring simcha, joy to us. But you know what? Sometimes the more they do, the less appreciation we have. Why? We take it for granted. We're expecting it. Sukumtuns, it's coming to us. And adarabba, because they're so good, sometimes that itself is the greatest measure and problem that we have. I was mentioning Shabbos, you know, Shabbos morning I spoke, and I had mentioned the mashal that Chazal tell us about a father that carries his child, the Medrash says. And the child is on the shoulders of the father, and the child says to the father, Abba, could you pick up that thing for me? Father picks it up. He goes again, Abba, pick up this thing for me, picks it up. Again, Abba, pick this up for me, picks it up. He keeps on walking with the child. On the road, the child meets a stranger, and he says to the stranger, you know where my father is? You know where my father is? The father says, you don't know where I am? He throws him to the floor, yeah? And a wild animal comes on him. The Medrash uses that as a mashal, you know, that the Klal Yisrael said, you know, that Klal Yisrael said the Eibishter, yeah, is God with us, right? Where is he? Is God with us? You know, when they, you know, needed water, so they said, Hayesh Hashem b'karbeinu, is God with us? God says, you don't know I'm with you? He says, I'll send Amalek. He'll remind you I'm with you. The same idea. How can that be? The idea is, of course, the same concept. It's called Regilus. It means you became so desensitized by the fact that they lived with miracles and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with them all the time that they already had lost the appreciation of what they received. They had lost the magnitude of the gift. Their relationship was compromised as a result. So too, you know, this is marriage. Marriage is the same thing. Yeah? The more they give sometimes, the less sensitized we are and less appreciative as time goes on to the many gifts that a wife bestows upon a husband. I want to tell you a maisa about a Rebbe, a very smart Rebbe. Maisa was a man comes to a Rebbe, and he says to the Rebbe, he says, I don't love my wife anymore. I've lost love for her. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to pray that she dies. I know you're a holy man. And whatever tefillah you give to God, God listens. So I have this unusual request. Daven that she dies. So the Rebbe, taking a little bit back, says that usually not as my repertoire of tefillah. It's not what usually you understand I daven for, you know. However, I do have an eitzah, a suggestion, that will accomplish the same purpose, but will not implicate me as much. This is my idea. He says, what you should do is, when Rosh Hashanah comes, make this great pledge of enormous amount of money. And we know that when a husband does not fulfill his pledge, that one of the onshin, the punishments that come upon him, is his wife dies. So make this, you understand, enormous pledge. Tell them you're going to buy the building. Yeah. They have a building campaign. You're going to go ahead and donate the whole building. Yeah. And that's all. And then Michelle Telford, you know, you won't pay the pledge. And she'll expire. That's it. He says, Rebbe, great idea. Kansafrid. Comes Rosh Hashanah, you understand. They make the appeal. First one that gets up, and that's it. He clears the boards, you know what I mean? He's it. They never heard in their lifetime he has such money, such a commitment to pledge. He's the hero of the shul. No. Only problem is, 1 month goes by, 2 months go by, 3 months go by, Hanukkah comes, his wife doesn't even have a sniffle. Garnished. She's as healthy as she ever was. He sees no deterioration. He's worried. He says, what's going to be with the pledge, you know? What is going to happen? I pledge all this money, and nothing happened to her. So he runs to the Rebbe already, Hanukkah time. He says, Rebbe, I gave it 3 months. I thought by now, for sure, something would materialize, garnished. Rebbe ponders the Shaila. He says, I tell you what. You know, it has to be an onesh. How is the Eibishter still going to work such a thing for a person that his wife should die if you make a pledge and you don't fulfill it? It has to be a punishment. The Eibishter looks down. What does he see? He sees a fellow that could only wait, you hear, that can't wait until his wife dies. That's no punishment. Mele, he says, it's never going to work like that. What do you got to do? He says, you got to start giving. You got to show somewhere that min hashamayim, that at least it appears that it means something to you, this marriage. And that indeed, you understand by your actions, it is something that could be deemed a punishment if something happens to her. He says, Rebbe, that's a great idea. So what does he do? The next day he goes out and he buys his wife, you hear, flowers. Mom just added a blue. That's a nice card, you know. And he says to her, yeah, how it means to have this marriage, and how much she loves her. And buys this, yeah, bouquet of flowers. She sees he buys flowers. She goes ahead and makes him, you know, a special meal. Yeah, a supper like he never had before. Nope. Another week goes by, nothing materializes. So what does he do? He starts again giving her something else. He buys her a gift. Buys her a gift. Ooh. She goes ahead, you know what I mean? And takes him out on the town. Meanwhile, this keeps on going, you know. And comes already, you know what I mean? It's the summer. And you know, it keeps on escalating. He comes back to the Rebbe, he says, no, what happened? He says, Rebbe, I got a big problem now. He says, what? He says, Rebbe, I fell in love with my wife again. What am I going to do now? What should I do now? He said, I tell you what you got to do now. Before Rosh Hashanah, you better pay your bill. What's the moral of the story, Rabbosai? Don't start up with a Rebbe. So true to life. What is it? Yeah, it's to give. It is to find opportunity in every marriage to be able to be aware, to observe and appreciate the kindness that they do. You know, I don't know if I really should put this on tape. If it is a tape, maybe I'll just let my wife hear it, you know. You know, I think in the terminology of Chazal, the man is called, you hear, the recipient. And the woman is called the nosein, the giver. We are the takers, and they are the givers. And in general, that's usually the case. Of the sofkel sof, if we are the takers, at least we should know how to say thank you. I always tell people, you give a woman a finger, she'll give you a hand. Yeah, b'derech hateva, they want to do. They want to give pleasure. They want to extend. they are, as they were created, an Ezer Kenegdo. But you have to be Makir Tov. Two most important words in marriage is Hakares HaTov, to appreciate the good that they do. And if you'll do that and find opportunity, and especially to accentuate it around the time when a woman comes back from mikveh, it's a very, very sensitive and important period and moment. It's something you understand that will garner great results and great benefit. You know, their hergeshim, their sensitivities in general, are much different than ours. And at particular times of the month, you know, they are different feelings than we have. To them, it's a very special occasion. The whole count is very special. Beyond the halachic issues, the psychological issues that are involved, we have to be sensitized and to recognize it. And when they come back, you know, that we should be aware again of the importance that it has for them, and that our efforts, and by our way of appreciation and showing, and our recognition of this, in fact, will, you know, cement and establish and give them, you understand, what in essence is the validation of their existence. I believe firmly, regardless whatever they'll tell you, women's liberation, whatever it is, the ikar tafkid of a woman is to be a wife and a mother. And the order is exactly what I told you. A wife first and then a mother. Not a mother and a wife. A wife and a mother. I believe a wife first and then a mother. As basic as it is for a woman to be a mother, I think it's more fundamental in her nature. And that's a pasuk in Chumash. She was created to be an Ezer Kenegdo. Adam says, I can't be by myself. If Adam didn't say that, there'd be no Chava. I need. So the Eibishter made her for that. Adam didn't say, I need children. Adam didn't say, I need children. He sees the animal kingdom, they'll have children. Didn't say to the Eibishter, I need to be a father. Says, I need a wife. So Chava was created, first and foremost, to be a wife. That's her essence. But we are obligated to recognize that. I would like to add just one last thought by way of introduction, and just the machshava, you know, the hashkafa, the attitude and approach we have to have. If there is indeed a requirement for Hakaras HaTov, which is the Aseh Tov, which is fundamentally the doing of the good, the recognition, there also has to be a Sur Meira. We have to remove ourselves from Ra. And what does that mean? I would define this as that one has to have the companion, Takaras HaTov. One has to have respect for a wife. I saw a very beautiful Maisa. It's brought down that Reb Chaim Volozhin had a brother. Reb Chaim Volozhin had a brother, Reb Zalman Volozhin. He was the Talmud, they were both the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. The father, Reb Yitzchak Mevolozhin, had two children like that. There are different accounts about how you have children like that. It just doesn't come. One story is that Reb Yitzchak Mevolozhin was a socher, he was a businessman. And his wife was pregnant. And she was giving birth. And in the house where he was the Rav of the city, Volozhin. His name was the Shagas Aryeh. And he had come to the house of the Rav, because, to the house of Yitzchak Mevolozhin, to look at his shas. Reb Yitzchak Mevolozhin bought a shas. He had the only shas in the whole city of Volozhin. Today, who doesn't have a shas? You have a big shas, a little shas, you have it on a, what do you call it again, on a disc, everything. One shas in the whole great metropolis of Volozhin. And what he did was, he came to the house of Reb Yitzchak Mevolozhin, even though Reb Yitzchak Mevolozhin said, I'll send you one of the volumes, what you need. He said, no, I'll go to the house better. Came to the house, it was Erev Shabbos. And there, his wife was giving birth in another room. And she knew that the Rav was there, the Shagas Aryeh. And in the midst of labor, they didn't give her a cordial. She didn't get anything. It was natural. And she didn't want to be mafriyahim. She didn't want to disturb the Rav. Didn't want to take a second of his learning that she should scream. And so she contained herself to an extraordinary degree. The baby was born. And the Rav heard, Mazel Tov. So the Rav said, what happened? So he said, Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhin's wife just gave birth. He says, I didn't hear her scream. I didn't hear anything. She didn't want to be mafriya the Rav. She didn't want to, in any way, distract him. He said, for her chashivas ha-Torah and her mesiras nefesh, I give her a bracha. She'll have two giants in Israel that will be her children. One was Reb Yehiad Chaim Volozhin, the other one was Zalmi Volozhin. They were the two Gedolim, the two most outstanding Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. Just unbelievable. The other source that I saw brought down, the very beautiful thing, he brings down here that Reb Aaron Kotler was given to have said the following story. He says, I heard that Reb Chaim Volozhin has said, what did his father, Reb Yitzchak Volozhin, do to deserve his brother? He didn't say him. He said his brother, Reb Zalman Volozhin, what did he do unusual? So he said, the Gemara Rosh Hashanah says, Kol parnes hamatil eima yisera al hatzibur. Any parnes, what is a parnes? Means a Rosh HaKohol, means one who is a sustainer of the community. Somebody in a position, a president, maybe a rav, anybody who's in a position of authority. Hamatil eima yisera al hatzibur, who puts upon the tzibur, because of his position, eima yisera, undue fear and trepidation. He says, shalo l'shem shamayim, not for the sake of heaven, eina roe ben talmud chacham, will not be privileged to have a son who will be a scholar. See, he said, Michlal lav atosho meyahein. From that which you understand, that which will forfeit a child from being a Talmud Chacham in the family, he says, my father, he says, was a Parnes HaTzibur. He was a man of means, and he had a position of authority, but he never put Ema. He never ruled with fear and trepidation upon his family. And for that, he says, as one who does it forfeits and loses the privilege of having a son, a scholar, one who is ever careful and treads ever so gently will be zocha inversely to have not only a child who is a Talmud Chacham, but to that extent will he have a child that will be a gadol, a child that will be great. You know, when I saw this story, I said, what application does it have? It's only for a few people, people in a position of authority and leadership. You know who is a parnes? Each and every one of us is a parnes. We are the parnes of our families. If for a tzibur that you are a parnes, you forfeit the privilege of having a child, a Talmud Chacham, if you put undue fear and stress in a family, in a tzibur, you lose the privilege of a Talmud Chacham. How much more so in a marriage? A person is a parnes. You are the head of the family. How important it is that the children and your wife should not live in fear from their husbands. You know what it's called? It's control. In many ways we do it. You control them. You come and yell at them. Sometimes we do it financially, control the purse strings. Sometimes we do it, you know, Chalila, sometimes physically people do it. In many different ways, you know, I have to tell you, you know, I read an article in Newsweek magazine a number of months ago, what the single greatest problem that women, you know, have with husbands, the greatest single problem is the problem of control. They marry a husband that's totally controlling. Controlling the family. I don't want you to see this one. Where are you? I mean, the BDD have a yufta. I know a woman like that. She couldn't go out. She couldn't do anything. She had to tell him where she was all the time. If the meals weren't good, he would get up, and what would he do? He'd say, I don't like it. Doesn't say it tastes so good. He got up and makes up his own. Where's your menschlichkeit? Rabbeinu the Amakula. The single most frequently discussed criticism in marriage is the matter of control. So I just bring it to your attention. It's a matter of kavod. It's a matter of respect. It's a matter of honor. It's a matter of dignity. Treating them with the kavod, with the respect and honor that's due them. How careful and how sensitive they are. They're much more sensitive than we are. And you know, as it says, L'Torah L'Chupa L'Maisim Tovim, Hakaras HaTov begins at home. If we'll have it at home, we'll be able to expand on it to other people. If there's no Hakaras HaTov at home, then there will not be a springboard to other people as well. And of course, you know, the overriding thing is this understanding of the appreciation, the respect, the Hakaras HaTov will bring Simcha into our lives, will bring Simcha into the marriage. And if there will be Simcha, then the Shechinas Hashem will be Shruya. Then with that, the Spirit of God reside in our homes. I complete this part with a Meisim once. I saw by my Rebbe when I always was blessed. I had a special privilege from heaven that in yeshiva, there must have been 25 people in the blachir at that time, 22 people in the blachir, and seats, yeshiva had tables, there were like two tables like that. And you know, the boys would sit around the tables, so they would be in the front of it. The most coveted seat would be the seat next to the Rebbe. And how was it determined who sits next to the Rashiva and what seat you have? There was a goyrel every zman. A goyrel means there was a lottery. And I always won the lottery, almost like it was rigged. Yeah, just b'nashamayim. And the best part of the lottery was that whenever you sat next to the Rashiva, he would talk a lot to himself. You know, his feelings or whatever it was, he would talk in an undertone. And I would be very, very careful to hear what he would say. Because I know those were things not for public dissemination, but rather you understand these were his own personal musings and feelings. And I would always listen. And I would, if necessary, would follow up and ask him a little bit about it. You know, I figured if it came and I heard it, surely it's something that I have to react to. So one time, he goes ahead, he comes from the Blachia, and anybody knows the Rashiva knows, he's not given externally to emotion, though deeply feels, but rarely will you see him cry. You'll rarely see him cry. And Yantif, he cries, and Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, he cries. But like this, you know, the burdens that he carries are very private. He comes into Shir and he's crying. You know, his ear is teary, you know. So the Shekhinah is not there, the Shekhinah is not there, the Shekhinah is not there, the Shekhinah is not there. I don't know what he's talking about. Where isn't it there, you know? Where? So afterwards I said to him, Rebbe, you look terrible today. And I said, you look teary-eyed. What happened? He says, a wife just called me that somebody that I knew hit her. Her husband. The Shekhinah is not there in the house anymore. The Shekhinah is not there in the house anymore. The Shekhinah is not there. God has left. You know, the whole idea, you know, the Shekhinah is Hashem, the Spirit of God. I'll finish. I remember, just from mentioning the thing, I remember one of my, a younger fellow than me was getting married, got married in the yeshiva. We have a weekend, as you know, every year at the end of June, last week in June. And we go to that weekend, and it was his Sheva Brachas, and he had a very small family, and he got married at the end of June, and his Sheva Brachas was at that weekend. And I remember that the Rosh Yeshiva at that Sheva Brachas on Motzoi Shabbos was in extremely good spirits. And he was dancing, and he was dancing, and he was dancing, and he's a very fine dancer. But this time it seemed to me his step had a little bit of an extra spring to it. You know, so I went over to him at the end of the dance and I said to him, Rebbe, I gotta ask you. I see you dance all the time and it's usually very beautiful. But Eppes today was just a little extra special. And there were other people that got married. Why were you so happy today more than other times? I picked up on it. His beautiful blue eyes, you know, looks at me with the glint in his eye that only he has. He looks at me and smiles and he says, Colin, he says, today is my anniversary. I'll always remember that. The simcha. You know, it was incorporated. Today was my anniversary. That's what? Simcha. You know? Mitzvah Hashem, the prescription for simcha, for joy, for shalom bayis, we all have it. If we just apply ourselves, if we are aware, and we're makir tov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be with us, and we will be matzliach, and we will be successful. And that is the single greatest bracha that we could ever have, is a house that's built on simcha and a very strong and wonderful relationship. There is no greater gift that we could have than a strong home. Does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask? I have become an authority on marriage after almost 25 years of counseling. I once had a couple here, and they went to a psychologist a lot of times it doesn't work. Anyway, so, you know, they came to me, they said, the marriage was almost gone. I said, maybe Rabbi, you can help me. So I said, I'll try, you know. So they came for 5 sessions. I saved the marriage. So they said, you were far better than any psychologist. How can we ever repay you? To which I told him, you can repay me. Don't tell anybody I know how to do this. Don't do me a favor. Don't tell anybody I know how to do this. For the prices that I charge and for the accessibility that I provide, you can't beat it. Just don't tell anybody how it was. Give the psychologist all the credit. Okay. I will go over a overview of the halachas, just that we have to know most of the halachas. Obviously, the details, of course, are subject and to the oversight of our wives and the diktuk hadin and the, you know, minutia of the law, that obviously they're the ones, you know, that have the mitzvah and then are involved, you know, teg toglach, you know, day in and day out in the you know, observance of it, but at least the jargon we have to be aware. And a quick overview about Taras HaMishpacha, the halachas, I think I can do in quick order. The halacha is, of course, that a woman becomes a nida, as it's called, you know, when there's any issue of dam that she has. This matter of the issue of the dam is if there's a flow, or even if it's not a flow, anything that comes forth, even tipas dam kechardel, even the smallest amount, even the size of a mustard seed, makes a woman tamei. This is min ha-Torah, this is according to the Torah. However, there's also a thing called a kesem, and I have to tell you, you know, I am surprised and many times that I do get many, many shilas from women. Thank God, I mean, that is an area that I do have many, many shilas from. And it's interesting that at times, sometimes, you know, the basics, you know, are forgotten. A kesem, a woman that has a stain on a garment, on an undergarment, that does not render her tamei unless it is the size of a U.S. penny. If it is less than a penny, and there is no hargosha, there is no sensitivity that a woman feels there's an issuance from her. She doesn't feel any zivas dovalach, she doesn't feel anything coming out, but rather observes it, and it's on a white undergarment, then the halacha is If it is in one concentrated area, not, you know, an area that adds up to a penny, all the dotted or speckled area, but rather in one continuous area, it adds up to a penny, then the halacha would be that that woman would be asur, but that's only midirabbanan, not only to say that there would be any difference in halacha, but it's a rabbinical prohibition versus the other is a Torah prohibition. If it's less than a wat, a penny, then the halacha would be, if there's no hargasha, if there's no sensitivity, that anything is issuing forth, then the woman would not be tamei. Even if the color was definitely a blood color, it would still be, without question, mutter, would be okay. I once saw Rabbi Feinstein. You know, I had occasion for many years to study with Rabbi Feinstein, these halachas. Together I saw with him, you know, they had 1,000 maris, 1,000 shilas we observed, 1,000. And I saw him once go ahead, and they showed him a mara on white, you know, and he took a U.S. penny, and he put it up against, you know, the streak of color. The color was not good, yeah, and the streak was measured, you know, by the size of the penny. He looked at here, looked at here. Can it visit? He says, I can't tell exactly if it measures exactly the penny or not. Now, since it's a derabbanon, since a kesem, which means a stain on a garment, is a rabbinical prohibition, and I can't determine that it is, in fact, the full measure of the penny, suffik derabbanon lekula. Since it's a question of a rabbinical law, then the halach is suffik midrabbanon, you take what? The lenient position. We have this, for instance, by brachas. Yeah, by a bracha. What? If you're in mesupik, if you made a bracha or not, what's the halacha? You don't have to go ahead and repeat the bracha. Not only don't you have to repeat it, it is prohibited to repeat the bracha. Suffik, the rabbanon, is lekula. So there was a practical halacha. With regard to the colors that are involved, you know, yeah, then it depends, you know. If it's yellow, not bad. If it's gold, it depends. It have to be a very shiny gold to be a problem. Pink, depends. A hefsek tara would be a problem. If it's not a hefsek tara, pink would be okay. Rabbi Feinstein used to say that's called roja. He used to say rose, that's pink. And then once we brought a shaila to him, he looked at it, it's red. He said, ich weiß nicht, was das ist, aber Blut das ist nicht. He says, I don't know what it is, but it's not blood. I can't tell you what it is, but I can tell you what it isn't. He says, it's not blood and it's okay. And then there's browns. That's already the quagmire. Different types of browns and shades and colorings. You should just know that a mara, a color, yeah, is not the function of one color, but many times it's a mixture of red, yellow, or other things that come together that create this hue, that creates the shading and the color. And so therefore it has to be. One time, somebody brought in a color chart, Sherwin-Williams, to Rabbi Feinstein, and wanted him, you know, to have in hand, you understand, from the Sherwin-Williams chart, and point out what's good and what isn't good, to be used from then on in by this fellow, you hear, as a way, you understand, to tell whether or not there is, you want, like a doctor to see, you take a specimen, see if there's an infection, you know. It's not going to work. Ramoshi did not want to get involved in that. He was very much against that. It has to do with the tone, the texture, the measure of it. You just have to have a feel for it. But Lamaisa, a woman is believed to say, I've seen this color before. She called up a rav and said, remember the shaila you asked me yesterday? I brought to you yesterday? It's exactly the same color. A woman is believed to say on the color. If she says exactly the same color, she's believed to say. So that's the thing. If you do a bedika, a woman does an internal examination, whether it be done during Shiva Nikiyim, the 7 clean days, or it be done what? During the days that she's expecting her period, then any color on that, which is a bad color, right? If it's a reddish color or very bad brown, no matter how big the size of that color, she is prohibited. Because anything that's done internally is deemed as a suffik d'oraisa, as a Torah issue. So it's not viewed as a kesem, something that is sustained from without, but is viewed as what? As that which is the potential of a d'oraisa from within. And so therefore she has to be very careful and circumspect with regarding to this. I would just mention, you know, that in depending upon what day she is in the Shiva Nikim, the questions become that much more lenient. And in rare circumstances, I would even ask her on a seventh day, but it doesn't usually happen. Rarely, recently it happened, but it's would be very difficult on the seventh day. It would have to be really, you know, something very bad for to ask her a woman on the seventh day. Let's go over what the woman has to concern herself with from the time that she gets her period. Woman gets her period, what do you got to do? She gets it 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's called day what, Rabosai? One. She comes down from Monday, right? So it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's 4 days. Friday is the fifth. Friday, she makes a hefsek tara before what? Before sunset. Women, I must tell you, I must get countless telephone calls a year about women that missed the time. Missed the time for the hefsek tara. They call up and they went over the shkia. At the beginning, I found it very difficult to understand how that happened until my wife explained it. But women are busy, she says. You know, it could happen. It's not. You have 2 minutes after shkia. Rabbi Feinstein explained to me, Rabbi David Feinstein explained that shkia, which is sunset, which is the cutoff point, is 2 minutes. 2 minutes after is still considered day. So if it's within 2 minutes of sunset, it still could count for that day. Just know for yourself. Okay? You can convey it to your wives. All right? 2 minutes is the time that you have. Or now don't leave it to the last 2 minutes. All right? Okay? All right? Then what we have after that, we have 2 minutes. We have shkia. And then what do we count? What? We count, 7 days. I would just mention that the cutoff point, day is counted regarding all these halachas by shkia, by sunset. It's not by tzeis hakochavim. So any time the flow begins before sunset, not tzeis hakochavim, then it's what? It goes from shkia to sunrise. Sunrise begins the day, not 72 minutes, not alos hashachar. Sunrise begins the day for these questions. So if a woman sees at night regarding keeping her calendar, you know that maybe we'll get, I don't know if we'll get to that, but keeping her calendar, you should always know that night begins when? With sunset. The day begins what? With sunrise. Okay? This is not the same with all other halachas. All halachas is what? You could dive it in the morning from Alos HaShachar, but this is not so regarding the halacha you hear of Taras HaMishpacha. She counts what? 7 days. At the end of seventh day, after the seventh day is completed, she goes to mikvah in the evening. She makes 2 bedikas a day. She makes 2 checks in the air, 1 in the morning and 1 in late afternoon. Please let it be known that if a woman were to get 1 bedika during that time, you know, it would be okay. Yeah, let's say you're supposed to make 2 and she only made 1 any particular day, it would be good. If a woman forgot a day entirely in the middle, it usually would be good. Don't miss the first and last day. Not good. Don't do that. Okay? And of course, obviously, you should be careful to do all the days in between. Okay? And then the woman goes to mikveh. And I don't want to go through the halachas of chatzitza, the care that she has to take. That, you know, there are 2 halachas that rabbis have to know very well. One of them, my Rebbe told me, is when in shul, they call you up and they have a problem with a Sefer Torah. You can't start opening your hair, Shulchan Aruch there, in front of Tircha de Tzibura. That's not going to fly. And the other thing that I learned from experience, and that is a horror, Shaila, which is not, it's not a horror, but for a rabbi who doesn't know, it's is when they call from the mikveh. It's 10:30. The woman is distraught. This is her problem. She's crying. What could you do, Rabbi? Well, the woman calls from home. She just came back from the mikveh, and she's home. And she found something that she was unaware of, that she have to go back to the mikveh. You got to know those halachas well. It's not a time, I'll call you tomorrow. take two Addison, I'll call you tomorrow. You got to know on the spot what the halach is. These are the very, and the other one that's very difficult, of course, is the shilas about an Erev on Erev Shabbos. Right? I'll let you know next Shabbos. You know, he's got to know what, yeah, what the old Seymour's waiting. Those are the halachas that you have to know. The halachas we will go over now quickly, the halachas that concern us, you know, are the ones directly related to us, are the halach of the safeguards with regard of the harchakas. And let me run them through quickly for you. You know what the harchakas are? The requirements, you know, that there should be not only not intimacy, but expressions of, yeah, I would call them expressions of love, you understand? Yeah, from a husband to a wife and a wife to a husband that are not permitted during this particular time. Let it be known that the man has much more restrictions than the woman. And let me explain to you. Let's say a husband leaves over some food on his plate. Are you allowed to go ahead? Is a woman allowed to eat from that food that's left over? The answer is yes. If the woman leaves over food on her plate, is the man allowed to go to take it? No. The answer is no. If, let's say, a man leaves over some of his drink, could the woman take it? Yes. If the woman leaves over some of the drink, could he partake of it? No. There is a way in which it could be done if it's transferred to another vessel. If it's put into another container, another glass, it could be done, but if it's not, then it can't be done. Yes. She can't pour for her. Yes, no problem. Yeah, she can. Yeah, you know, no problem. Yes.
So if you're let's say you're a mitzvah or another person home or something, you give them the tray to take from to put on your plate, you can't take from
to
your wife plate.
Right, you have to do no. You are not, if there's a center tray. Yeah, what you do is you take from that platter and then you put it on your plate that you're allowed to do. You can't eat with her from that center platter and take from that directly and to go ahead and take it into your mouth. But you're allowed to take from that center platter, you understand, to go ahead and do what? To take from that and to go ahead and put it and transfer it into your plate and to eat from it. I am sure I would imagine that hors d'oeuvres going around. Yeah, that you took your Frank on that side, and then she's on the other side taking your Frank. I can't imagine that's a problem. Okay? I'm sure that would be fine also as well. Okay? That's all right. Don't make me sugar. Okay? That's definitely okay. Okay? Butter taken from a butter dish and taken thing is okay. You could do that as well. Okay? A wife does not serve her husband in front of him, pour in front of him. You know, even if it's pour. She doesn't serve him, you know, unless it's done with a shinui. What does it mean? Either the plate is set down a little distance from him, or she does it with her left hand, where usually she would do it with her right hand. So there's a hekir, there's a differentiation, there is a what, in a way it's distinguished than it would be in other circumstances. Yes?
Now, that would bring up a possible problem come painted time when one person supposed to serve the other person. And pouring wine for that person.
When you wine, you don't send your wife kiddush. When you make kiddush, you have to set it a little bit away, not in front of her. Okay, so you set the glass, you know, a little bit, you know, and she goes ahead and takes it. The idea of even, you know, setting it for her, in front of her, is not appropriate. With regard to the halachas, for example, about sitting, a man is not to sit on the bed of his wife. A woman could sit even in his presence on his bed and lie down in his bed, but he is not allowed to do the same. He has to be very careful of that. Another example of where there's a differentiation, you know, between husband and wife in terms of the halachas with regard to sitting down in the bed and things similar to that. If there are any... these halachas, you know, are, you can't hand your wife something, but there are klal, you shouldn't throw something to her. You are allowed to throw it on an ark, you know, but you can't throw it straight to her. It's a problem with children. You can't give little children. You should really set them down and then go ahead unless you want to throw them. I don't think that's your objective. You know, so what you do is you set the child down. I do want you to know, Kach Ra'isi by Rebbe, I lived in his house. The Rosh Yeshiva never handed, or did the Rebbetzin never handed to the Rosh Yeshiva anything in all the years. I think it was an extraordinary sense of tznius that nobody ever knew when were the times that are heter and when the times that were mutter and when wasn't. Because they never handed anything to each other. So since they never handed anything to each other, one could never distinguish, one could not differentiate between the times. It was just, that was a special madriga, you know. Tznuim, you know. That's why some people are Rosh Yeshivas, you know. The rest of us, you know. Anyway, it was a very, I saw it, I observed it, you know, in the house, that all the years that I was there, I saw the thing that was there. The last halacha that I want to refer you to is, of course, the halacha, you know, that a woman keeps a calendar, expectations of when the vestos, the menses are. There is a ves benini, there's a ves hachodesh, and there's a ves haflaga. A ves benini is what? 30 days. A woman that doesn't have a regular cycle, that means she has to anticipate that the next time she's going to regulate herself. What is the period of regulation? A ves benini means what? 30 days. From the time she sees her period, she counts off on a calendar 30 days. And on that 30th day, she is to expect her period. She's not to have relations with her husband. She has to make a bedika and has to check to make sure. Then there's called a ves haflaga, means those are the interval days. Interval days taken from the time that she saw this month and when she saw last month and the count of the days in between. And the interval days, no matter whatever they are, that same period of interval days are counted toward the next month in anticipation when the next period will come. You understand, counting off those interval days. And the last one is the Vest HaChodesh. Means the day of the month that she sees is the day of the month that she can anticipate the next month that she will see again. I'd just like to mention in conclusion that these Vestos that we are talking about, Vest HaChodesh, Vest Beinoni, Vest HaFlaga, if a woman knows that she never sees less than 30 days, in other words, she never sees less than 31 or more, that is her regularity. She doesn't know after that she may see 36, 35, 34, 33, 32, whatever, but never sees less than what? Than 31. Then she doesn't have to keep the Vest HaBeinoni or the Vest HaChodesh. She doesn't have to keep those two times because she's already regular to the point that she doesn't do what? She's regular to the point that she doesn't ever see less than 30 days. And so therefore, she would only have to keep one, which would be the Vest HaFlaga. Those are the interval days. I'd like to conclude just by telling you that Rabbi Feinstein told me that when he was a Rav in White Russia, he said, you know, we call this an irregular period, when a woman, you know, doesn't have regular. The truth of the matter is that's an anomaly in halacha, because usually a woman will see regularly. It is rare that a woman has a vest that is kavua, a regular cycle. Rabbi Feinstein told me that when he was a Rav in White Russia, he said every woman in Russia, where he was the Rav, had a vest kavua. Not only to the day, but a woman was able to see to the hour. She could mark the calendar, the clock, to the hour they always saw. He says, "Ich weiß es, was hat passiert in Amerika." He says, "I don't know what happened in America." Says, "Ein gekommen da." He says, "I don't know if it's the water." He said, "It's the avir, it's the environment. I don't know what happened. I just know that a ves kavua was kavua, and that is much even where he was in Russia. That was the derech. That was what was universal." Came here, he says, became a different world. So it's interesting, you know, from Chazal, we think, you know, yeah, just a few years ago, this was the derech. In America, everything changed.
Bigly, that is challen, one aver is challen the entire animal. There we're taking it a step further. But the Gemara wanted to suggest that it's only one migui. The fact that it becomes Kiddush HaGof is not a Migoy, to which the Gemara responds, no. If he was Magdish at Kiddush HaDamim, you can't tell me that it's automatic Kiddush HaGof. He didn't say Kiddush HaGof, he said Kiddush HaDamim. It's only that Chazal say, Migoy, that there's Kiddush HaDamim, will make it Kiddush HaGof. And once again, we're left with the Shaila, that if we used up one Migoy to turn it from Kiddush HaDamim into Kiddush HaGof, can I now take another one and say that Migli, that the Kiddush is Chal on one Eber, it should be Chal on the entire card.
Who's Yotzeit is the second day of Pesach, and the Zech Nishmas Abdoi Veb and Av Moshe, who's Yotzeit is Erev Pesach, sponsored by the Gwurtzman family. Our Magid Chair has been Rabbi Fishel Shechter, Magid Chair at Yeshiva Mesifta Torah Vadas. You've been listening to the Al Daffi Project of the Torah Communications Network.